You know, one of the biggest mistakes that we can make in life is to buy into the myth that more is better. That bigger is better, that money and the things that it can buy will make us happy. Today, we're going to continue our sermon series that we began a couple of weeks ago, Living on the Edge, and talk about the secret to happiness. You know, most of us don't think of ourselves as wealthy. As a matter of fact, surveys have found that people tend to look at those who make exactly double of whatever they make as rich. So no matter what their income level is, they think that someone who makes twice as much as they do, well, those guys are rich, they're wealthy. For example, if you make $25,000 a year, you know, someone might think that, hey, you know, someone who makes $50,000 a year is rich. And it just goes on and on. So $50,000 a year, well, then the person who makes $100,000, they think are the wealthy folks. Even billionaire Ted Turner isn't happy with his income. He said it's all relative. He says he sits down and he says, now I've got $10 billion, but Bill Gates is $100 billion. I feel like I'm a complete failure. I think, well, hey, that's not too bad for a failure. Sign me up. Anyway, okay. But don't get me wrong, all right? All right? Money in and of itself isn't bad, okay? And that's because in the world that we live in, we need money to survive. It's a system that we use in order to pay the bills and to feed our families. And we have to have transportation and housing and clothing and etc. Money, therefore, is a necessity. But the Bible tells us that money can become a problem. Take, for example, what the Apostle Paul tells Timothy and the church at Ephesus in 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verses 9 and 10. There he says that people who want to get rich fall into temptation and a trap and into many foolish and harmful desires that plunge men into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. Some people, eager for money, have wandered from the faith and have pierced themselves with many griefs. So again, money itself is not the problem. It's the love of money, right? That's the problem. It's the all-consuming pursuit of it. Think of it this way. When getting more and more money and more things becomes your primary goal in life, then you've probably got a problem, okay? You see, when we have that kind of a mindset, then we'll stop at nothing to get as much as possible, thinking that, you know, if I just had maybe a little bit more, then I'll be happy. Then it'll be enough. But along the way, we end up maybe compromising our beliefs a bit and stop serving the Lord. And so it's that desire, really, for more and more that's really the problem. That's really both dangerous and destructive to our relationship, not only with God, but with those around us. Jesus himself told us that we cannot serve both God and money at the same time in Matthew chapter 6, verse 24. The reason being that when we divide our focus like that, one always will become primary over the other. Which is why later Jesus said that we are to seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well. In other words, you know, if we choose to serve God in all that we do, then God will make sure that we get what we need. The problem comes really in being happy with what we get and what we have. And so with all that in mind, what we're going to do today is spend a few minutes looking at four biblical examples of people who thought that the secret to happiness was the riches of this world. And then we'll go ahead and take a look at three biblical keys to the secret of happiness. So first, happiness is not found in money. Happiness is not found in money. And while we pretty much just said that already, I want to share just one example, really among many, that shows this truth at work. And it's found in chapter 7 of the book of Joshua. And it involves a man by the name of Achan. Now, in order to better understand what's going on here, let's go ahead and set our context. It was back in Joshua chapters 5 and 6 that we read about Israel's first victory in the conquest of Canaan. They've entered the promised land. They finally got there after wandering around for 40 years, and they were able to go in, and with the Lord's help and obedience, they conquered Jericho. You remember that the Israelites had gone up against that great walled city, and they easily took it when they obeyed God's instructions. Sadly, in the middle of that great victory, a man by the name of Achan did something that he thought would bring him happiness. But instead, it brought some serious consequences down on everyone, and really permanently on himself. You see, after the Israelites defeated Jericho, Joshua sent spies up to their next target city, to the city of Ai, to scope things out, you know, a little bit of investigative spies or whatever you want to call it. And the spies returned and they reported that they didn't need a lot of people to go up and attack Ai because they didn't have a whole lot of men up there anyway, and they looked like they'd be easy to overtake. So Joshua sends out just 3,000 men to go up into battle, but they are beaten terribly by the men of Ai, and they force the Israelites to retreat. Of course, you know, the Israelites were kind of upset at this, and they're rather confused about their failure because they thought, hey, you know, how can we have lost against this little Ai place after all of God's promises and this great victory we had at Jericho? How in the world is this happening? So being the good, godly leader that he was, Joshua, along with the elders there in the community, fell face down on the ground before the ark of the Lord until evening, asking God, why? Well, God told them the reason in verse 11, saying, Israel has sinned. They have violated my covenant, which I commanded them to keep. They have taken some of the devoted things. You see, one of the commands that God had given them when they went up to Jericho was that nobody was to take any of the plunder. Everything was to go into the treasury of the Lord. And so the whole community suffered because of Achan. And if that wasn't bad enough, Achan didn't even confess his sin until it was impossible to hide the fact that he did it. You see, what happened was that God had made the people come forward, tribe by tribe, then clan by clan in the tribe, and then family by family in the clan, and then finally man by man in the family. I don't know, that kind of like gets me on edge thinking about it. Just kind of imagine it, you know, and being a little uncomfortable. I could imagine Achan going, please don't pick me, you know. And it would just be narrowed down to each one. First his tribe was chosen, then his clan, then his family, and then he was chosen. And when it happened, Joshua tells him in verse 19 to go ahead and fess up and tell us what you've done. And in verses 20 and 21, Achan finally told the truth and said, it is true. I have sinned against the Lord, the God of Israel. This is what I've done. When I saw in the plunder a beautiful robe from Babylonia, 200 shekels of silver and a wedge of gold weighing 50 shekels, I coveted them and took them. They're hidden in the ground inside my tent with the silver underneath. Yeah, you know, Achan did bad. He did. He sinned and hid. But I think it's fair to say that we can all relate to that pull of things, to those things that do attract us, and how something can catch your eye and then consume our thinking until we simply have to have it. And it might be the latest cell phone or car or outfit or whatever it might be. It all starts out with that gaze leading to the greed, which leads to the grab. The gaze, greed, grab thing, you know. 3 G's. It's clear that Achan knew that what he had done was wrong. It had to have been, or else why did he hide it? You know, why did he hide it all in his tent? Because if he didn't think he did anything bad, he'd be parading around in this robe with all this, you know, bling on, looking like, a king. He'd be decked out with all the silver and gold, but he didn't do that. He hid it, you know. But you can't hide from God. You can't fool God. And in the end, what Achan thought was going to bring him and his family happiness cost him and his family their lives. You see, we're told that he and his family in the end were taken out and stoned to death. Their bodies were burned, and a large pile of rocks were piled up on top of it to act as a reminder, a memorial, that the secret of happiness is not found in money, but in obeying God. Again, happiness is not found in money. Happiness is also not found in property. There's an interesting narrative that happens in 1 Kings chapter 21 involving King Ahab and his wife Jezebel. And just in case you don't know, King Ahab and Queen Jezebel, depends upon your accent, right? And Queen Jezebel were notorious leaders in divided Israel, in the northern kingdom of Israel. Now, the piece of property in question was actually owned by a man named Naboth from Jezreel. And it was a nice little vineyard that had been in his family for generations. Unfortunately, his vineyard also happened to be right next to the king's palace in Samaria. Now, what had happened was that Ahab needed a good place for a vegetable garden, because we all know that kings need to eat their veggies, you know. And he decided that Naboth's vineyard was close by and it would suit him just fine. So he went to Naboth and he said in verse 2, "Let me have your vineyard to use for a vegetable garden, since it's close to my palace. In exchange, I'll give you a better vineyard, or if you prefer, I'll pay you whatever it's worth." And to me, that sounds like a pretty good deal. I mean, it's really kind of a win-win type of deal. You're either going to trade off for something better or actually get what it's worth anyway. But the Bible tells us that Naboth replied in verse 3, "The Lord forbid that I should give you the inheritance of my fathers." Now, to be fair, Naboth wasn't trying to be difficult here. He wasn't trying to, like, say, okay, I'll hold out for more money or anything like that. You know, he was simply just trying to obey God. Because if Naboth had sold off the land that his ancestors had passed on to him, it would be the same as Esau selling off his birthright to his brother Jacob for a bowl of soup, which of course he did. The idea here is that keeping the land of your ancestors meant not only that you honored your family, but also that you were recognized the covenant that was made with the Lord for the land. So, what did Ahab do, you figure, in the face of this denial and defeat? Did he go out and say, "I'm going to kill this guy," or he went home and he pouted? It's a little crybaby. He went home and sulked. You know, the Bible says in verse 4 that he went home sullen and angry, lay on his bed sulking and refused to eat. Maybe kicked a little bit and went, "Mommy, mommy," or something. I don't know. But then when the missus came in and found out why he was so upset and pouty, Jezebel said, "Hey, aren't you the king?" In other words, hey, it's good to be the king. Go out and exercise that muscle of yours, you know. You can have anything you want. No one can stop you. You're the king. Sadly, again, the kings of the divided kingdom in North Israel weren't at all good kings. And they didn't at all follow in the ways of good King David. So Jezebel, who did not really care a whole lot about the religious teachings of United Israel, if you will, having no spiritual commitment at all really to the one true God, decided that she would go ahead and make sure that what Naboth wanted he would get, but through a little bit of trickery. And so she immediately set in motion a plan to falsely accuse Naboth and have him executed. See, that way it wouldn't look like the king was trying to get his land, but that he died and he just sort of picked it up because it went up on sale, you know. Hey, this guy died, buy his property, you know. So she has him executed, and once Naboth is out of the way, then Ahab could have the vineyard. Of course, everything goes according to the way Jezebel had planned it, and when Naboth was gone, Jezebel went to Ahab and said, "Hey, stop pouting about everything. Get up and go take the vineyard you wanted, because Naboth had an accident. He's dead, you know. He's no longer with us. Go get the land." So Ahab happily goes out and he goes down to take possession of the property that he thought would make him happy. But as you could probably guess, God's not going to let him get away with what happened. So in response, God sends the prophet Elijah with this message in verses 19 and 23. He says, "Have you not murdered a man and seized his property? In the place where dogs licked up Naboth's blood, dogs will lick up your blood." And not only his, but Jezebel's too, telling him that dogs will devour Jezebel by the wall of Jezreel. And to make a prophetic fulfillment story that's quite long short, that's exactly what happened. Because, again, happiness is not found in possessing property. Speaking of possessions, happiness is also not found in possessions. Over in the Gospel of Luke, in chapter 12, starting in verse 13, we're told that someone in the crowd said this to Jesus. Said, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." So Jesus said, "Hey, you know, who made me a judge or arbiter between you?" And then he shares a parable with everyone. And he says, "Watch out. Be on guard against all kinds of greed. A man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions." And he says this, starting in verse 16, to drive home the point, this parable. He says, "The ground of a certain rich man produced a good crop. He thought to himself, 'What shall I do? I have no place to store my crops.' Then he said, 'This is what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns and build bigger ones. And there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I'll say to myself, you have plenty of good things laid up for many years. So take life easy, eat, drink, and be merry.' But God said to him, 'You fool, this very night your life will be demanded from you. Then who will get what you've prepared for yourself?' This is how it will be with anyone who stores up things for himself but is not rich toward God." So again, we see here that the rich man is quite proud of himself in the parable for having done so well. As a matter of fact, he uses the first person pronouns I and my a total of 11 times. And it's not just a good crop he has, but he's also got a lot of things. And there's nothing wrong with having a good crop or having things, but when you've wrapped up your identity around all of your things, when you're more concerned about where you put your things as well, instead of, I don't know, maybe sharing it with others or just giving it away, then instead of you holding on to possessions, possessions have a hold on you. Later, Jesus will say in Luke 16:9 to use worldly wealth so that when it's gone, you'll be welcomed into eternal dwellings. Again, happiness is not found in possessions. Not found in possessions. Happiness is also not found in being selfish. It's kind of connected to what we've just talked about, obviously. And since we're in Luke 16, if we move down a little bit, down to verse 19, Jesus tells us the account of the rich man and poor Lazarus. Seems that the rich man just enjoyed himself immensely. You know, he dressed himself up in purple and fine linen, and he lived a life of luxury. All the while, at his gate sat a poor beggar named Lazarus. He's covered in sores, he's hungry all the time, just fantasizing about the little bits of scraps that might fall from the rich man's table. How if he were just to get those, it would be a feast. But poor Lazarus never got even a crumb. This rich man, living there all that time, with Lazarus by his gate, simply ignored him. So he guzzled and he gorged and he garishly gowned glamorously until into the grave he had gone. Of course, Lazarus, well, he too is eventually laid to rest. But Jesus tells us that they went to two very different places. Poor man Lazarus went to where Father Abraham was. Father of the faithful. But the rich man went to a terrible place of torment. Now, just to make sure that we're all on the same page again, just because the rich man was rich isn't the reason he went to the place of torment. He went to hell because he was in love with his wealth instead of being in love with his fellow man. The ironic thing is that we see in this account of the rich man is that he ended up being in the position of a beggar, begging for Lazarus to give him just a little drop of water to ease his suffering. But sadly, Abraham told him that it just is impossible. Here's what Abraham said in verses 25 and 26. He said, "Son, remember that in your lifetime you received your good things, while Lazarus received bad things. But now he is comforted here, and you're in agony. And besides all this, between you and us is a great chasm that's been fixed, so that those who want to go from here to you cannot, nor can anyone cross over from there to us." He said, it's done. The second greatest commandment that Jesus said comes into play here, to love your neighbor as yourself. It's just too bad that the rich man didn't learn that lesson before he died. And so while the rich man thought that he found the secret to happiness, he really didn't. All he found was the secret to selfishness. Again, happiness is not found in money, and it's not found in property. It's not found in possessions or in being selfish. And the important thing for us to do is really to not be like Achan, and to not be like Ahab or Jezebel, God forbid, you know, and to not be like the rich man in either parable that Jesus shared in our lesson today. And again, while that's a little bit easy to say, because it is easy to say, to not be like them, it's not always easy to do. Because we are tempted day by day by these kinds of things. I mean, we're not to remain idle. We want to push forward. We want to achieve. These are good things, you know. But if that's the only reason that we're doing it for, then we've missed out on the purpose of what God has blessed us with. That's why it's important to know that there is a great danger and destruction from coveting more and more and more, from never being satisfied. And there's a great danger and destruction, again, from hoarding what we have and not sharing it. I'll admit, it's like last year I cleaned out some of my garage and I threw away stuff from like 10 years ago that was in a box, some computer tech that I thought I'd save. It was so outdated, there was no point in keeping it. It wasn't even e-waste. It was just metal boxes with some wires. It's pointless to save that stuff. I could have gave it to someone a long time ago and they could have made use of it. Again, when you think about stuff like that, though, things like money aren't the problem. It's really our attitude toward things like money. And it's the love of those possessions and money instead of love for God and our fellow man. You know? And thinking back to what Paul wrote to Timothy in 1 Timothy 6, we could see that he really shared three important keys to happiness, to true biblical happiness, that could really help us keep our focus on Christ every day, to be able to experience that. Take a look back at 1 Timothy chapter 6, this time starting in verse 6, where Paul writes, "But godliness and contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into the world, and we could take nothing out of it. But if we have food and clothing, we will be content with that." And so two of the keys of happiness are right here: godliness and contentment. And in a nutshell, that basically means that it's important for us to focus on the spiritual, and then to learn to be content with whatever it is that we have that's material. And that's not to say, again, that we shouldn't try to better ourselves, or, you know, but to remember again what our focus is supposed to be. Okay. The Hebrew writer said it this way in Hebrews 13:5. He said, "To keep your lives free from the love of money and to be content with what you have. Because God had said, 'Never will I leave you, never will I forsake you.'" Again, we're told right there that we need to remember that God is really our greatest possession. Our focus needs to be on God, not on money. And those things come into play as we put God first, you see. Back in the gospel accounts, when Jesus was talking about sowing seed in the parable of the sower, you remember. Again, that's the good news of the kingdom. He told us that there are four basic soil types, right? Four basic types of attitudes that people have who hear the gospel in the parable of the sower. And Jesus told us that the one who received the seed that fell among thorns is the man who hears the word, but the worries of this life and the deceitfulness of wealth choke it, making it unfruitful. You see, if we're so worried about hey, you know, do I go to work? Do I attend the worship assembly? Do I go ahead and put in the offering, or do I go ahead and buy that, you know, Google Play card so I can play Clash of Clans all night or something? Do I, you know, or upgrade, you know, this or that on something? So if money is busy wrapping us all up and getting us so tied up into things, then it's going to choke our faith out, and that will just be our focus. So our love of money can definitely override our love for God and for others. Solomon, wisest man, all the scriptures, said it best this way in Ecclesiastes 5:10. He said, whoever loves money never has enough. Whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with his income. I mentioned in our Bible class this morning that entrepreneur and creator of the Tesla, Elon Musk, was for a brief moment last week considered the richest man in the world. Then stocks fell and Bill Gates became again the richest man in the world. But does it really matter how many bazillions of dollars you have if it's not helping out somebody else or furthering the kingdom of God? You know? Again, godliness and contentment are two of the keys to happiness. And the third one we want to mention is generosity. Generosity. Again, toward the end of 1 Timothy 6, Paul writes, starting in verse 17, to command those who are rich in this present world not to be arrogant or to put their hope in wealth, which is so uncertain. Number one this week, number two next week. But to put their hope in God, who richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment. Command them to do good, to be rich in good deeds, to be generous and willing to share. In this way, they will lay up treasure for themselves as a firm foundation for the coming age, so that they may take hold of the life that is truly life. In other words, it's important again to remember that God owns everything, and that our heart always goes where we put our money, and that heaven and not the earth is our home, and that giving is really the only attitude toward materialism. And that really God prospers us not to raise our standard of living, to see how high we can push our budget, but to raise our standard of giving. Okay. So you want to know the secret to happiness? Well, it's got to do with godliness, contentment, and generosity. But the only way that those three keys will offer you any kind of happiness is if the source of that happiness comes from knowing God through Jesus Christ and His Holy Spirit. And so today, if there's anybody here who would like that happiness that comes from Jesus Christ and you're not saved, well, you could have it by being saved and heaven bound. All you need to do is believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God, and recognizing that you're a sinner and that you need to change your life, well, come forward and confess that Jesus is Lord, giving Him your whole life, surrendering to Him in Christian baptism. Maybe you've already done that, but you're still struggling, or maybe there's some other need that we might be able to help out with. Maybe you have a prayer request or something. As always, you're always encouraged to come forward as together we stand and sing.